We got as far as this with some explanation. I think the main explanation was how you use it, given in an empirical way, given that the formula itself is not empirical. That you use it in a sequential way so that no matter what you observe, either you were right and you can say that's all there was to it, or you have something new to look for and to demonstrate. You mean here?
Yeah. And so what left me was in the same place I was before, I got an idea of this was pulled out.
Yeah, if you find an exception and can't figure out which of these it is, then there's no reason why it couldn't. These are not particularly mutually exclusive.
But by having more than one, all of a sudden I found myself in the same unknowing place.
Well, it makes a difference to know that it's one or more of these four than just to know that somehow it's not going right. You have a better chance of zeroing in on what's going on if you know that it's... Keep in mind that these formulas and no formulas are informative. They won't give you answers. See, what you're suggesting is that it ought to have given you the answer, and that since you didn't get an answer, there's something defective about it. And the formulas don't give you answers. They give you places in which to plug in answers. Yeah. And if you plug answers in here, the answers will be answers, and they will make the kind of sense that the formula does express and make explicit. So if you just start with a vague, something's wrong here, you're in sad shape if that's as far as you can go. If you sharpen it up a little and say, what I'm doing doesn't feel natural, or what I'm doing doesn't fit somehow, well, that's a little clearer than just saying something's wrong. If you can go further and say, I know something of this sort, and yet what I did doesn't fit, something is wrong. You've got even more of a hold on it. And if you can say, well, I know I've got this, and what I did didn't fit, and here's how it didn't fit, and it's got to be one of these, you're quite a bit further down the line. And then the next step is to decide which and how much. So you're practically there with the formula, even though, indeed, the formula doesn't give you the answer. And again, you may have cases where it's hard to tell which it is or whether it's more than one and so forth. Or you have other cases where it's easy. Now, these four clauses, I don't know if I went through it before, are keyed to these three parameters. And they're just another way of saying that if the right behavior doesn't occur, it doesn't occur because there's something missing either of this sort or of this sort or of this sort. And those are the only ways that it could happen that the right behavior doesn't occur. And the reason you have two of them here is because you have that distinction between doing something and knowing what it is you're doing. So basically the K, if it's only intentional action, involves the distinctions that are called for in whatever you do. The fourth unless clause involves this distinction. You may be mistaken about what behavior you're engaging in, even though you're making the relevant distinctions for engaging in whatever behavior you're doing. So, for example, if somebody puts me down and I respond with an insult, I've made the distinction that's required in order for me to respond with an insult, namely, I recognize I'm being put down. I may not recognize that what I did was an insult. I may not know that I am responding to that. I may not know that that's the behavior I'm engaging in. Now, because there are those two possibilities in the K parameter, you have two of these four unless clauses dealing with cognitive things, and only one with the other two. Basically, these unless clauses are simply a reformulation of the ways that a behavior could fail to occur. The ways it could fail to occur is if you don't have the right things here, here, or here. It might. In what way?
Yeah. Okay.
Well, keep in mind the role of observer is already here when I distinguish my being put down. It's not just present when I think that I am giving an insult. Any K, any value of K will imply observation. Now, one of the crucial things as far as using this formula is you have to be able to, number one, distinguish some relationships. The example I used last time was if I'm his friend and he asked me for the paper, I'm liable to give it to him. You distinguish some relation when you say, I'm his friend. Secondly, you've got to distinguish some behaviors, of course. And thirdly, you've got to be able to recognize, at least to some extent, for some behaviors and for some relationships, which behaviors fit which relationships. You have to not only distinguish being friends from some other sort of relation, you also have to be able to recognize what sorts of behaviors friends might well engage in. What sorts of behaviors would be expressions of the friendship. Now, if you can't do those three things, you won't be able to use the formula. The formula clearly requires that you be able to do all three. Now, it doesn't require that you distinguish every relationship there is or every behavior there is, or be able to match unambiguously every behavior to some relationship. Simply that to the extent that you can do those things, you can use this formula. But nobody can do it for all behaviors and all relationships, etc. No, he may decide it on a particular occasion. See, for example, if you'd never seen either of us before, you could still say, because of what you saw me do when he asked me, it looks like he's his friend. Now, to be sure, you probably wouldn't say it with great confidence if that's all you had. But you could, you see, because you're dealing qualitatively the kind of behavior and what relationship it would fit. And for that, you need only one observation. That ties in with what I was saying before, that this kind of description you can give on the basis of very limited information, including the kind that is available on a single observation.
Can you give the definition or a paradigm case for relationship?
No. You recall in that set of transition rules for objects, process, events, states of affairs, relationships was also one of the basic terms. I don't know anybody who's ever been able to give a definition of relationship in general. What you can do is do some contrasting and explaining. You can say, when I say the cup is white, I'm not talking about a relationship. If I say the cup is on the table, I am talking about a relationship. The cup is on the table, and the word on is what identifies the relation. If I say I like him, I'm identifying an attitude or a relation. If I say I dislike him, if I say I'm suspicious of him, if I say he's my friend, he's my father, he's my brother, he's somebody I don't know very well. Okay. All of these are ways.
You're putting a behavior also. Hmm? The idea of relationship is something you're putting on.
In a way, it's a limit, and the way it's a limit is expressed by the formula. See, if I say I like him, in effect, I'm setting limits to the kind of behavior between me and him that would be appropriate. So one of the things you can say about relation, it takes more than one thing in order for there to be a relation. You can't have a relation if you're only talking about one thing. That's why saying the cup is white is not talking relation, whereas the cup is on the table does. If you say the cup is in the room, or all of us are in the room, all of those are relational statements. If I say I'm to the north of him, that's another relation. You see, there's all kinds of relations possible, and all you can do is point to them, but as I say, I'm not sure anybody has even tried to define a relationship. It's one of those things that you learn so early and so fundamentally that you start there.
You say it's a state of affairs concerning two things.
Well, not every state of affairs concerning two things is a relationship. For example, if I say this cup is similar to the one in the other room, that's not a relation between the two cups. It's a fact about them, but not a relation. So even though logically it probably read the same formula. But keep in mind that all of our loose talk about interpersonal relationships or intimate relationships or personal relationships will be instances here. Those are the kinds of things that are included in talking about A being related to B. You'll find in the long run, though, that this is so general that it doesn't even have to refer to persons. It will apply no matter what you're talking about and no matter what kind of relations you're talking about.
You find in a lot of the literature statements like doesn't such relationship is useful. Is that kind of a weird way of stating that what they did was an expression of the
relationship? Yeah. See, saying influence, I think, has enough connotation of causality to say that it's misleading. It doesn't have to, but I think when somebody talks about something influencing something, you usually take it in causal terms. And this is not a causal relation, unless you're using causal relation in an equivocal way. See, for example, you might run into this kind of argument. Well, saying that you gave it to him because he was your friend isn't really an explanation, because it doesn't tell us what caused you to engage in that behavior. And to that, the answer would be, well, if you want to talk about causes, I guess you'd have to say that his asking me was the cause of my giving it to him. In a causal formula, that's a perfectly good cause, with my behavior being the effect. However, you'd have to recognize that that doesn't explain anything either. Because had I not been his friend, his asking me wouldn't have produced that effect. So why would you take it to be an explanation just to say, I gave it to him because he asked me? So what you really need is both. That given that I'm his friend, his asking me will lead me to give it to him. If I'm not his friend, his asking me will lead me to do something else. Unless you have both kinds of information, namely what I was reacting to and what the relationship is, you haven't understood what's going on. So there's a place for both historical and non-historical sorts of explanation. Now, in traditional formulations of science, this corresponds to the difference between causal laws and initial conditions. See, for example, if we had a cannon here and put a cannonball and shot it off, and the ball fell 3 miles north, you could not explain that fact by talking about the laws of motion and the amount of energy. Because all of those facts could be identical and the ball falls somewhere else. What you need to include is that the cannon was pointing north and it had a certain elevation. Then in conjunction with that, the laws of force and motion will explain why it fell where it did. But you can't do it with just one or the other of those two kinds of information. So this is the non-causal type of component. And usually, in explaining behavior, this is what we need because the causal part is usually obvious. If you were here, you'd have heard him ask me, and you'd have very little question about what was it that I was responding to and giving it to him. In that kind of situation, what you're missing is something of this sort. But clearly, there will be others where you're missing the causal thing, but simply come back to why, in general, we need both kinds of information.
How does that correspond to the analogy you were making with the cannonball of saying, why did the ball land there? Well, because I put the light to the fuse or something like that. Right?
Same thing.
Press the trigger. But so in
that's the prior event that is
right.
The cause. But it
now,
still is if it had been pointing
about
elsewhere.
You talk about motivation, about the forces, the and energy laws. Would they be causal or descriptive in that sense? I take it that this is the, or not.
The law, those laws would be causal.
They would be causal.
Yeah, because so, with in using them, you refer to other sorts of things, geometrical things, as initial conditions.
Okay, then. Would not, in his asking you, part of the causal picture, the causal aspect of your giving it to him, include your motivations?
No.
It wouldn't?
No.
Okay.
Those are the circumstances. Remember this diagram here.
Okay.
Here I had opportunity and motivation. And what one would normally identify as the cause is the opportunity. The motivation you can either have here as part of the circumstance, and I put it here because it changes over time, or you could put it up here.
So
the opportunity, though, is something you couldn't put here.
So your motivations and emotions would be more on the line of the elevation and direction.
Yeah, because had I felt differently, had I been motivated differently, he could have asked me, and I'd have tossed it in the wastebasket. So when you identify his asking me as the cause, then my motivation becomes part of the background condition.
Okay, that's what I'm asking. Is there anything more to the cause part that you're asking?
Probably not. The reason is that the cause has to explain not only why it happened, but why it happened when it did. And anything else that you might be tempted to include as cause would fail the test of why did it happen when it did. Whereas his asking me explains why it happened when it did, namely it happened when he asked me. That's why causes have to be events, because they have to happen at a certain time, because part of their function is to explain why something else happens at a given time, namely the effect.
That's why I don't understand how the laws of energy
Oh, wait a while. I'm sorry. Oh, it's the other one. It's the other one. Yeah. There is an event that happens. It's the application of a force here. Then the laws of force will tell you what happens from there on out.
So it would be the light and the fuse or whatever
that
would be. Right. That would solely be caused. Okay, that's correct.
So you might say that the laws of motion reflect geometrical relationships. And when you start something, it proceeds according to certain geometrical relations. Whereas with people, when you start something, it goes according to certain personal relations. Okay, any questions now about this particular one? If not, let's go to some special cases, which are the emotion formulas, and have exactly the same form, but are special cases. Well, there's one for anger or hostility. Provocation by A elicits a corresponding hostility by G unless G has a stronger reason not to, unless G doesn't recognize the provocation for what it is, unless G is unable to engage in that kind of behavior, or unless G mistakenly thinks that his behavior is a corresponding hostility. So essentially, they're the same four unless clauses as you have here. What this implies, however, is that this is one of these. That in referring here to provocation, you're referring to some particular relationship. Take this to be equivalent to hostile behavior.
Just seems strange to define it or to call a relationship provocation or as aggression instead of term.
It's simply a different one. Aggression is this kind of thing. It's a way of specifying a kind of behavior by reference to the style. An aggressive behavior may be hostile behavior, but it may be all kinds of other behavior. No, not unless you had a broad definition for what constitutes performance or style. Think of this classic case of expression of hostility. I'm somebody who knows you and meets your name on a list of people to be executed in the morning. And I have discretion as to who stays on and who doesn't. And I simply don't take your name off. Now, there's very little that you could say about the style of my behavior. It's not normally the kind that you would identify as aggressive. But you would sure as hell say that was hostile. See, on the other hand, if I go punch CJ in the jaw, you could say it looks like both. Certainly, that kind of behavior, style-wise, you'd say is aggressive. You say, why would people do that? Mainly, it's because they're hostile. So that kind would look like both. So there's no necessary connection between hostile and aggressive, even though there's a fairly strong empirical connection. That's right. In fact, that's what would lead you to look for. If you saw me doing that, you'd say, what the hell did CJ do to him?
And I guess for different people, different things constitute.
Right. Right. See, what I might find provoking, he might not. And there are social norms about what you ought to expect somebody to find provoking.
But a hostile person, though, still is responding to all kinds of provocation all the time.
Yeah. In general, we'll find more things provoking. Wherever there's a choice, he'll find it provoking rather than otherwise. In fact, I suspect that most of you know at least one such person who isn't so much extraordinarily hostile. It's that wherever he has a chance to find provocation, he finds it and responds with hostility. And he's the kind of guy you avoid. Because somebody who takes every chance that he gets to do that is certainly beyond the norm, and you want to make special allowances. One of the allowances you make is you avoid him. Now, this thing is not as clear as it could be because it's doing double duty. It's doing double duty for an event and a relationship. And the event is the event that introduces this state of affairs. See, for example, if he insults me, Whatever he says, his saying what he says is the event. Once he has said it, he has provoked me, and that is the relationship between us. He provoked me. Now, saying provocation is a way of talking both about this, what he did to bring it on, and what it was that he brought on. And again, you see, it's because it includes this that it serves as the causal explanation of why I responded with hostility when I did. It's the fact that he said it when he did that explains it. See, in contrast, if I've been mad at him for the last 3 years, and now I insult him, my being angry at him for 3 years does not explain why I insult him, although it may be part of the explanation. Because the question remains, why now? Why in these circumstances? And for that, you need some other information. Do you have a question?
Yes, I'm wondering if that translates well into behavior paradigm, in the sense that it is some kind of a motivational distinction that describes that behavior hostility.
I'm missing something.
It looks like there's some kind of motivational implication always in the discussion.
Emotion?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, and I'm looking for some kind of...
Right, here it is. Provocation will fit this, which gives you a kind of reason for choosing some behavior over another. Fear would be a case of this, which gives you a different kind of reason for choosing one behavior over another. And in general, various emotions will simply be instances of one or more of these. And they work the same way. If I see his behavior as provoking, I have a reason for doing certain things and not others. If I see him as a danger to me, I have a certain reason for doing things and not others. If I'm jealous of him, I have a certain kind of reason for doing something rather than something else.
What about that?
Say classy or classic.
What about the situation of the so-called just war theory?
Which?
Just war theory, that if a big country unjustly attacks a little country, another big country could come to the defense of a little country, and that's for moral reasons.
Well, that's just written large. If you see a big kid bullying a little kid, you come to the rescue of the little kid. Now, you don't have to be angry, but you might be.
The reason for that would be... Yeah.
That would be both ethical and aesthetic. That's right. Yeah. See, it's not fitting for a big kid to bully a little kid. It's also wrong. And when you see that kind of inequity, it also isn't fitting for you to just stand by.
But isn't that sort of the knowledge feature?
That's right. Absolutely. That's why we can say this with confidence instead of going out and doing experiments. Exactly. Well, no, it's fitting because it's socially it's both socially inappropriate and wrong. So there's something that stems from two perspectives, not just one. Yeah. See, there's such a thing as righteous anger, but not all anger is righteous anger. Well, that's a little less something that leads to the eye. Consequences can certainly be painful. I'm not sure you could say the angle is painful.
I'm talking about the
Oh. Right. Okay, now any question about this being a special case of the relationship formula or how this one works? Well, let's go to the one that's diagrammed in the book because we want to do certain things with this one. This is the formula for fear behavior. Notice it's not fear in general, it's fear behavior. Because we're talking about behavior here. Attempt to avoid the danger is a behavior. Notice again, this is a reference to a relationship. If he is a danger to me, that's a relationship between him and me. But also, if the storm out there is a danger to me, that's a relation between me and it. As I said before, relationships don't necessarily involve people. In the case of danger, is one of the few emotional ones in which we have all kinds of cases that don't involve a person on the other end. With provocation, you can take your pick and say necessarily it involves another person or paradigmatically it involves another person. Because sometimes you want to speak of getting mad at the table and kicking it. When it comes to jealousy, I can't think of anybody who's ever claimed that a person gets jealous of something other than a person. Would you say jealous, or would you say envious, or that you admire it, or what? Oh, that's not the kind of thing I mean when I say envious.
You mean jealous like what I thought you jump over?
Yeah, yeah, I wish I could, yeah. Oh. Or boy, I sure wish I could do chemistry like him, you know, this kind of thing. Or why should he have all of the good luck and not me? So those kinds of things, that kind of jealousy involves a relationship with a person. And one exercise for you is to ask yourself how many emotions do we have? You'll find that there's not a long list. And by the time you get down to number 6 on your list, you're going to be dealing with ambiguous, questionable sorts. See, once you get past fear, anger, guilt, and possibly envy and jealousy, you're dealing with things that you might call emotions, but you might not. Well, joy probably.
And love.
Now, love, think of as a relationship, but do you think of it as an emotion? Or is it being in love that's the emotion and love is just the relation?
Well, love is a relationship in the same way that danger is a relationship and fear is the emotion. It's probably corresponding.
Well, is there, you see. With love, it's much more clear that there's a relation involved than that there is a corresponding feeling or emotion.
Well, I recognize corresponding feeling or emotion.
But not everybody does. That's right. No, but that's what I mean by borderline or equivocal or ambiguous cases. See, you don't flinch when somebody says the feeling of anger, the feeling of fear, or even the feeling of guilt. But when it comes to the feeling of love, the feeling of ambition, the feeling of jealousy, it begins to fade away. Sadness again. Right. Which?
Right what? Sadness, you said right.
Oh. There, I think you don't blink an eye if somebody talks about it as a feeling. But some of the other ones that clearly are relationships and clearly operate in pretty much the same way that feelings do, you might not want to call them feelings. For example, ambition. Is ambition a feeling? It certainly operates in these same ways. Is greed a feeling? Is it an emotion? It operates in these ways. See? So what you have is a logical paradigm of which those things that are clearly feelings fit, but also a bunch of things that are not clearly feelings but are not clearly not feelings also fit. I want to save that until after we go through the danger one, because then I want to make some lists, including all of the feelings we can think of.
So someone says, I hate self-consent, I hate self-consent because of that feeling being reasonably hate, young.
No. You know, it might have been a guilt feeling. And then it wouldn't be H, it would be E. Or if it was this feeling, it would be prudential. What you do out of fear is certainly not a hedonic motivation. Which? This is not talking about pain. This is talking about danger. I can have a very painless death. I'll still avoid it. See, again, there's a lot of overlap. Some of the things that are dangerous are also painful. And in fact, you might say the prospect of being in pain may constitute a danger. But in general, danger is not the same as pain. And so hedonic motivation is not the same as prudential. That illustrates the difference.
Very fuzzy, and there's a lot of overlap.
No, there's no overlap.
Well, yeah, I mean, you could talk about danger, you know, the feeling of being in danger as somewhat painful.
Yeah, but look. The fact that particular cases may allow for various descriptions doesn't mean that the descriptions are fuzzy.
Oh, yeah, that's what I meant. I mean, they could both apply.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I was personally saying, no, it's not hedonic. Yes, it is prudential rather than saying, well, it's mostly prudential. There's an element.
Let's see. What was the question that I said? Oh, yeah. And see, there, that's a conceptual question. Doesn't danger involve avoidance of pain? I said, no, because it doesn't necessarily. And then said, yeah, you might have cases where you had both.
In your outline, you say you often consider the corresponding formula for fear, quote, danger problem. Okay, my question is, which is the R, fear or danger? Because sometimes there's danger with the fear and sometimes there's
no. No, danger is the relationship. It's the second unless clause. Unless he doesn't recognize the danger for what it is, then there's no fear.
Every time a person has fear, say I have a feeling of fear, I imagine you would say the fact of the person has a relationship to something.
No. It may be an imaginary fear. There may be nothing that's a danger to you, but if you think there is, you'll be afraid.
Oh, well, I was talking about if the lion comes into the room.
Okay. See why these paradigm cases come in handy. The lion walks in the room, there is no real question, is something really dangerous to you?
Okay, the lion comes into the room, and I have a deep fear. Mm-hmm. If I say, I feel fear,
say the next step would be to have a relationship.
I'd say that no matter what you say. See, I don't need you to tell me that to see the lion being a danger to you, nor do you. You don't have to tell yourself, I feel fear, in order to respond to the danger presented by the lion.
If it is a, if I have a non-imaginary field, but a real
I mean, if you have a non-imaginary danger.
No, I'm talking about feeling in general.
If it's feeling in general, save it for when we have the columns of different sorts of notions that correspond. Because feeling is going to be one of those. Having a feeling is not the same as feeling. Having a relation is not the same as knowing about it or experiencing it. That's why there's that extra column. Okay. Now, can everybody make the appropriate changes for the unless clauses? Unless he has a stronger reason not to, unless he doesn't perceive the danger for what it is, unless he's unable to act in that way, namely this, and unless he mistakenly thinks that what he did was a corresponding attempt to avoid. So you can see that you've got a schema in which at just at one or two places you plug in the right words and you've got a different emotional behavior. In place of provocation, you put danger. In place of attempt to avoid, you put hostility. You know, with these kinds of changes, the same schema will hold. And that schema is basically this schema. History. Remember I said that there are some other possible maxims. I mentioned several. One that I didn't mention is this one. A person takes the world to be as he has found it to be. Now, if I have found redheads to be dangerous, when I encounter one, I'll take him to be dangerous. If you found it to be otherwise, when you encounter one, you'll take him to be non-dangerous. That, in general, is how come people will differ in what they take to be dangerous and what they take to be provoking, etc. We can have exactly the same concept of danger and differ widely in which things we count as dangerous. Some which? It's a mechanism. Bring on the lion. Feel free to add. You're appealing to your concepts of greed and emotion. In the same way, if you say, is danger a relationship? You're appealing to your concept of danger and of relationship. And what else could you appeal to? You mean like ambition or greed, etc.? Those fit the formula. The question is, are they emotions? And those, I would expect people will answer differently. And you can see why. That somebody who's counting certain things will say, yeah, they're emotions. Somebody who's counting certain other things that are also there will say, no, they're not. And one of the main things that you can be going by that would throw you one way or another is there a distinctive feeling that goes with it? And there pretty clearly is not a distinctive feeling that goes with ambition. And that's one of the main reasons why you would say, no, it's not an emotion. Whereas in a case like love, you might say, yes, there is, or no, there isn't. And then that would decide you whether to call it an emotion or not. Yeah. Right. Okay, now let's take this and go to the paradigm case that's diagrammed in the outline. Here's a way of diagramming, distinguishing the lion, wanting to escape him, jumping out the window, and presumably succeeding in escaping him. Now, let's use one of our forms of description, namely the symbolic significance description, which you recall we diagrammed like this. And this is a case of engaging in this behavior by engaging in this behavior. Now, here we have danger. This is an intentional action. I engage in this one by engaging in this one. Now, this is a way of representing the fact that I recognize the lion as a danger. See, both of these are cognitive. That given this discrimination, I'm motivated to avoid the danger. Since it's the lion that's the danger, my motivation to avoid the danger translates into emotion to escape the lion, or motivation to escape the lion. By jumping out the window, I escape the lion. By escaping the lion, I avoid the danger. So you have two intentional actions together there, in which you engage in one by engaging in the other. What I said was, this is a representation of a case where you have two intentional actions. You may do two things. Whether you do or not depends on whether these values are correct, whether they're more than my descriptions, whether indeed you distinguished the lion and were trying to escape the lion, but also saw the lion as a danger, and we're trying to escape the lion as a way of avoiding the danger.
If I were an observer of this parable, I would say you succeeded in one and failed in another if the window was on the 10th floor.
Yeah, I might be avoiding that danger, but running into others. Yeah, but they could indeed be both intentional actions. They might not be, but that's why I say that this diagram represents the case where you have to. And certainly, if you stop to think about it, it almost certainly would be two. You'd be saying, how can I avoid that? Well, I have to get out of this room. I'll have to escape from that line, so I'll jump out the window. And you would have explicitly plugged in all of the right things. So you might say, as an observer's reconstruction, this is pretty safe. As corresponding to what went on, it's open to judgment on particular occasions. And what we're interested in is the fact that it could be what's going on. It is a possible phenomenon, and that's the kind of phenomenon we're talking about.
This might be just a crazy man of art. Why do you avoid danger, not escape danger?
Either way, you could formulate it either way.
I can't see how that you could be avoiding danger. You're in the presence. You're in the presence of the line. You escape from that presence or the danger posed by the line.
Okay.
You
know? No, it's the performance of intentional action. You do this by doing this. The achievement is to escape the lion, avoid the danger. No. Mental. It's a behavior. That's what you're doing. You're avoiding the danger. You're also escaping the line. You're escaping the danger. Now notice there's nothing about lions that's intrinsically motivating. It's only if I see the lion as dangerous that it makes sense that I try to escape him or something else. But just to say that's a lion doesn't give me any motivation. If he's behind bars, if he's dead, etc. His being a lion doesn't make him a danger. But if I decide he is, then I am automatically motivated to escape. There isn't a gap between danger and seeing danger and the motivation to escape, in the way that there's a gap between seeing something as a lion and the motivation to escape. There's a gap here, there is no gap there. That is, to see something as dangerous is to be motivated that way, whereas to see something in a lion is not per se to be motivated this way. And that's the importance of these notions, is exactly that there is no gap between the cognitive and the motivational. To see something that way is to be motivated that way. That seeing him as a lion doesn't necessarily motivate me in any way. It's only if I see the lion under some other description that I'm motivated. See, lions do not fit under these categories. It's only when you connect lion to something like this that you're into these categories. No. Prudential reason. You appraise something as dangerous, and when you do that, you're motivated to escape. Whereas if you describe something as a lion, you're not per se motivated in any way. In the same way, if I describe something as drinking from the cup, that doesn't motivate me. If I describe it as drinking something pleasant, that is motivated. No, he'd see these. When you see me getting away from the lion and somebody asks you what he did, I would bet 99-1 you couldn't give a good description of my performance. What you'd say is he's getting away from the lion. And then we could probably reconstruct a lot of the performative aspects of what I did. But you wouldn't come out with a nice performance description and then worry about what I was doing. Not as any normal observer. Furthermore, you'd probably focus on this. You'd say, he's acting like he's afraid of the lion. And that's even though you could see everything else in the room just as clearly as you could see the lion, you'd pick out that lion. So remember, in discussing these forms, I said one of the reasons for studying this is that you can get, often you can get a lot of agreement. And here you can carry these things around, but that you can overdo that. And in fact, only under exceptional circumstances do we ever know a lot about performance. That mostly what we do is recognize the action. Oh, there is. You're not escaping the lion by avoiding the danger, because there's all other ways of avoiding the danger than escaping the lion. There's very little in the way of interchangeability. If it were, you couldn't put him this way. You just say he's doing both things at once. But there is also this asymmetry. And the asymmetry shows up in the motivation. That you get the motivation from here, and this is merely the performance that goes with this action. And if you didn't have this motivation, this action would not occur. And that's the asymmetry. Yeah. But one was done by doing it. Think of this as a means-ends relation, which it is. You do one thing by doing another. This is the means of accomplishing this end. A means-ends are not always this way, but this is one of them. Now, if we look closely at this example in the diagram and ask, is what we have in the diagram enough to mark this as a case of fear? The answer is no. We need a couple of things in the picture that are not easy to diagram, but that you can write down. And those two are written in your outline underneath the diagram. Now, the first one of those conditions simply takes account here that we haven't filled in anything under the KH. And the first condition says, in effect, that KH is really there. And discursively, it comes out saying the individual has some learning that is relevant to acting on that discrimination. So that takes care of the one that we didn't specify. The last one, he has a learned tendency to act on that discrimination without deliberation. That one is in there in order to distinguish specifically fear behavior from simply prudential behavior. If you're simply talking about being cautious, all of these things would hold except that last condition. For example, if I saw that lion and I merely said to myself, well, I guess I better get out of here for my own good, and I'll do that. And then I calmly move out the window in an orderly fashion. You would say this guy is being careful or he's being cautious, but you wouldn't say I was afraid. The condition that distinguishes emotional behavior includes this impulsive character, that you have the learned tendency to act on that discrimination without stopping to think. Now notice this is just a tendency. This is not to say that emotional behavior is impulsive, or that when you behave emotionally, you do not stop to think, or that whenever you don't stop to think, you are behaving emotionally. It just says there is a learned tendency that way. No, because that's taken care of here, that he has some learning that's relevant to acting on that discrimination. Therefore, you don't have to specify which learning or which way, just that there is relevant learning. And the relevant learning will differ from one person to another depending on their experience. And that's why you can't specify. So that last condition then distinguishes fear from the more general sorts of prudential behavior. Now you recognize that this last condition is why emotional behavior is associated with control problems. Because if we, given that condition, it means that as soon as you make this discrimination, you're going to act unless you prevent yourself, unless something is in the picture to counteract that. Because given the discrimination, you have the motivation. Given the motivation, you have the tendency to act, and you have the learning relevant to it. And if that tendency is the tendency to act without thinking, you've got something approximating a reflex that says as soon as you spot the danger, you're already avoiding unless somehow you can prevent that. Now, this feature then explains both why emotions are associated with problems of control and impulsivity, and also why emotions, even though they're yours, appear to you phenomenologically as something that happens to you. You don't have a choice about them. When I see the lion, I don't have a choice about being afraid or not afraid. Since it happens in a way that's not under my control, I often experience my own feelings as things that happen rather than something I do. But then that's hardly any different from saying, look, if I look at the wall, I have no choice about seeing it as cream colored. This one. That's part of the learning, is to the tendency to act without deliberation, which means you're able to do it, and the relevant sorts of performance, at least some relevant sorts of performance. Okay, now, given that we have the additional two conditions for this as a paradigm case of fear, now we move in the other direction and say, well, suppose we wanted to subtract out the particulars of this case of fear so as to retain only what is common to fear behavior in general. Because this is certainly just a particular example of fear behavior. It's certainly not fear behavior in general. We say, what would we have to wipe out to wipe out the particulars of this example and retain the general characteristics of fear behavior? Well, having this kind of division, it's simple. You simply wipe this out. That is, you wipe out the lion, because that's clearly part of the situation. You wipe out escaping the lion, because that goes with the lion and not some other kinds of dangers. You wipe out the jumping out the window and whatever learning goes there, and you wipe out this. What you're left with is this one, which involves danger, escape, learning relevant to acting on the concept of danger, the tendency to act on that discrimination of danger without deliberation. Learned tendency to act without deliberation. The learned tendency to act without deliberation, it comes from your history. You learn to do that. Now notice, I'm not saying that you learn to act without deliberation. I'm saying you learn to act on the discrimination without deliberation. No, that's here. That's an additional condition that, as I say, is not easy to plug into the diagram. If you're going to plug it in somewhere, it would be here, because it clearly refers to your learning history, and that's what KH refers to. So when it comes to fear in general, we're left with danger, escape, and escape. Plus the relevant learning, the impulsive character. You could acquire that tendency by learning without learning to behave impulsively. Okay, now let's do the same thing again and ask, since this is fear behavior and not all emotional behavior is fear behavior, what happens if we wipe out all of the features that are distinctive to fear behavior but do not characterize emotional behavior generally? Obviously, you wipe this out. But if you wipe this out, you have to wipe that out. We've already wiped both of these out. And you would also wipe out the particular here and just leave KH generally. And you would wipe this out, and we've already wiped that out. So, what are you left with? Well, if you say nothing, that's understandable. Remember Alice in Wonderland and the Cheshire Cat? Remember, the Cheshire Cat started to fade and fade and fade until all that was left was the smile. Well, we've got the same kind of thing here, you see. By starting with a concrete case and then deleting what's peculiar to that case, then deleting what's peculiar to that kind of emotional behavior, it looks like all we have left is the smile. But indeed, that is what we have left. What we have is simply a logical schema without any content. But the schema is what's peculiar to emotional behavior as against some other kind. How would we formulate the schema? Well, I think that I may, in the last revision, have put it in the outline. I know it wasn't in the preceding one. Is it in there? What paragraph is that? 10? 11G? Okay, refer to 11G there.